one of the major ideas behind this too is something that's really a truism in the communication discipline, that symbols create a reality. Mm. We create a reality through how we talk about something, mm-hmm. how we think about something. And so we always have a choice of, I can change my mind and I can change reality. Mm-hmm.
I'm Jillian Foster, and you're listening to the Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab, where I deep dive with provocative thinkers and doers to understand the why and how of their work. These activists, academics, journalists, authors, founders, and movement leaders ask tough questions and drive forward work at the edges of social change. Whether feminist by name or by deed, the Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab seeks to create a record of these voices. Each conversation takes on a life of its own as we dig into the often difficult and always interesting nitty-gritty of family histories, feminist awakenings, and the connective tissue that ties together boundary-pushing work. This week, we have two revolutionaries, Sonia and Karen Foss, twin sisters and partners in the feminist revolution. Sonia and Karen modeled equality and embodied feminism before they had the language to label it. Now, professors of communications, they work to tangibly create the feminist reality we envision for the future.
Tell me about where you grew up.
We grew up in Eugene, Oregon, and we had a very traditional kinds of parents. Our father worked, our mother didn't.
What did your father do?
He was a sales rep for Procter & Gamble.
Okay.
And our mother now and again would have a part-time job, or she would take a class at the university. So she was always doing these sort of little forays out into something different. But it was the 50s and 60s, and so sort of women didn't tend to do that. So I think we saw traditional gender roles sort of in action. Then another thing that happened was, because we're twins, I think we always had this model of equality. And so, I mean, we always wanted to be treated equally, and we always saw each other as equal. And so that sort of gave us this sort of odd feminist overlay, in a sense. and even today, if we're pouring something, like in a glass, we have to make sure it's exactly even.
And I think the other thing that was operating was we really didn't fit in. We were very nerdy and shy. So junior high and high school were very miserable for us. And I think largely they were miserable because of gender issues. I'm not sure we could have really articulated that at the time. And I suppose many junior highs and high schools were like this. But for example, on Valentine's Day, the boys could have flowers delivered to the girls in the homeroom. No one ever think about how awkward that was for the people like us sitting there with no flowers.
Yeah, they did that in my middle school and high school also.
Yeah.
It is a weird thing.
Yeah.
But actually, by the time they did it in my school, it's like anyone could send a flower to anyone.
Oh, that's very nice.
So then
so
it
you're
became
enough
slightly
behind
more.
Us. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other thing I remember that was particularly horrific was we had to ask a boy to walk in with to graduation. And I was one of the three people giving a graduation speech. So I was at the front of the line and I had to ask a boy, and I had to have a boy. I mean, it would have looked horrible.
Yeah.
Because all the girls without boys were at the end of the line, you know, and I couldn't be there. So, but Sonia and I should have walked in together. I mean, we were what made us survive high school. And so thank God these guys we asked said yes.
When you say it was miserable, like, was it miserable because of this, like, I am told to associate with a man or with a boy, but I am unable to, like, find that little man to be my partner in these situations? Or was it other things?
Well, it was that we never talked to any guys. We were so shy. And it just seemed like an odd convention.
Right.
Like this pairing up that didn't seem necessary.
It's really interesting because it's like your natural pairing is like you two because you're so close.
Right.
But then you're consistently told to pair up with an external person and
exactly.
a man or a boy
right.
at that.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
So the other thing I think that happened, sort of talking about how we became feminists, is even though we were desperate to fit in,
yeah,
we did some things in high school that deliberately made us not fit in. So, as example, all of the girls who were not cheerleaders joined the pep club. And so
what is the pep club?
Some kind of cheering thing.
Oh, it's like in the stands or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes. And so every Friday they wore these uniforms. We were the only two girls in the high school who did not join the pep club. We were the only two girls on Fridays not wearing these uniforms.
Now, what was your reason back then? Like, why were you like, we're not wearing
silly.
These?
Well, silly.
Why are these people playing sports? We don't care if they win or not. I mean, it made no sense.
Yeah.
So we're shocked to this day that we would do that. Right. And then when we had to go to assemblies, like, and everybody would stand up and cheer, we stayed seated. We did not stand up and cheer. This is the stupidest thing we've ever heard of.
Like, if you were cheering for the football team,
yes,
or something.
Cheering for the football team.
We thought, we don't need to do that.
Yeah.
Wow.
There were some lines we couldn't cross. We knew we couldn't cross them. We knew they were so stupid that we were going to hold our own.
Right. So, and actually, at a high school reunion, like our 20th or something, somebody said, you were feminist in high school, but we didn't have the label for it then.
What did they think of you back then? Like, if there was no label, what were you?
I don't think they thought about us much.
They were like, who are these people?
But I think they saw that we were doing something different. We were not doing what other people did. And for various reasons. Sometimes we couldn't. Sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes we didn't believe in it. Whatever. But
what did your family think of this? You know, like, did you have siblings and were they like,
no,
yeah?
No, we were just, okay,
just you. And what about your parents? Did they pick up on, like,
no, this, they were pretty oblivious. Well, parents didn't interfere in kids' lives back then. They had their lives, we had our lives.
I'm not even sure our parents knew we were the only ones who didn't join the pep club.
I'm sure they had no idea. We didn't talk about those things.
And just, what about the equality? Because you said, like, the equality started to seep in with your relationship with one another, and that was, like, the lens through which you started to see the world. Was there a disconnect between, like, the equality that you felt between one another and then any inequality between your parents' relationship or what your mother wanted to do? Or, you know, was there starting to be a disconnect anywhere?
Well, I don't think it struck us until our father was killed in a car accident when we were seniors in high school.
Oh, wow.
So then our mother had to start doing all this gender stuff, like mowing the lawn, but she also had to get a job. So all of a sudden we thought, oh, this gender stuff really makes no sense.
It's not very functional,
you know.
Right.
So,
actually, what's interesting, though, is I think because our father died, our mother went back to school. She got a bachelor's degree and a master's. And in fact, the three of us graduated with our bachelor's degrees together.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah. And she became a feminist. We came home from college once, and she was reading Betty Friedan's A Feminine Mystique. But I don't think that would have happened if he hadn't died.
Wow. So that was, like, a big point in your life.
Yeah, because then we really saw traditional gender roles don't work.
Yeah.
And actually, she went on to start Displaced Homemaker Centers for...
What is that?
Women who were widowed or divorced.
Okay.
And back then, you know, if you had no job experience, and some of them didn't even know how to write a check. So it was to help these women in the situation when the husbands were gone and they had to make it on their own. So
she wrote a paper for one of her classes in her master's program about this kind of program is really needed. So somebody at the University of Oregon said, well, let's get this started. So she directed it for about 5 or 6 years, I guess.
This was in Eugene?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. This is really great.
And they actually got legislation passed in Oregon to support displaced homemaker centers in that state.
Are those still around?
No, because they're not needed anymore.
Because
women,
now
women have skills. Most women work. You don't marry a man and not do anything.
Yeah.
So it filled the gap kind of in between the traditional thing in the feminist movement, in a sense.
Yeah.
And also a much-needed gap. And I love how personal it was to her.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. So you all three, meaning your mom and both of you, studied at University of Oregon?
Yes.
And what did you study in undergrad?
Romance languages, French and Spanish. We planned to be high school teachers.
You both did romance languages?
Yes.
Okay.
But then we decided right before we were going to student teach that we didn't want to spend our lives looking at confused faces, which is what you do when you teach a language.
Well, and we didn't want to go back to high school.
Right.
The bad memories would forward.
Right. Yeah. So some friends of ours were majoring in communication. It was called speech at the time. So we went over to the speech department and said, could we get a master's degree here? And they said, sure, take a quarter of classes and then we'll let you in.
Oh.
So We did.
We did, and they did, and there we were.
And how did you fund this? I'm curious. Like, was this scholarship or? Like,
we didn't have teaching assistantships back then. Or
no, but tuition was so low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we just kept working our regular jobs.
Just like kept going forward. Yeah.
One other thing, speaking of the jobs, though, during the summer we worked at this cannery, and this also talks about how we became feminists.
Yeah.
We worked at this cannery where you stood at this belt and these vegetables came through and you had to sort the good vegetables from the bad. And the women had to wear dresses and hairnets, and we stood in about 3 inches of water. Meanwhile, there was a man sitting at the end of the belt on a stool. This was the early 70s, late 60s, long hair. He had no hairnet on. He sat there until our bucket of bad vegetables got filled up, and then he emptied it, and then he went back to his stool. The men got paid 20.
Boy, he has a really hard life.
Yes, and they got paid 25 cents more an hour.
Oh,
we became feminists on the spot.
I'm curious if you ever did like any agitating from within. If you were like, we just found out we made 25 cents less than this idiot.
We were just college students.
This is, that's so infuriating.
Yeah. So that helped in the feminist evolution.
Was there ever one moment where you were like, oh, we're feminists? Or was it a slow progression, like a slow kind of change?
Well, I think partly we didn't have the label for a lot of these moments.
We also did read Betty Friedan.
Right.
And that was, I mean, it did change our lives, like everybody says.
Yeah.
I think it was just a lot of things.
Yeah.
Your dad passing away.
Right. You know, working at the cannery.
Yeah, working at the cannery. Yeah. Your mother re-entering.
Right. But then we also, another of our summer jobs was working at a campfire girls camp. And so it was just all women.
What are Campfire Girls, like Girl Scouts? Is that
what it is? Similar organization.
Similar organization, okay. But different.
Okay.
And so it was all women, all girls. And so it was really sort of the first time we'd been in this all-female environment.
Yeah.
And sort of everybody was accepted.
Yeah.
And everybody was affirmed and encouraged. And it was like amazing. And we drastically changed our personalities as a result.
We weren't shy anymore.
Even after the experience, you felt like a lasting difference.
Oh, yes. We're totally different because of that experience. Wow.
And so we sort of had this sense of women's world and the possibilities of what it would be like to live in this all the time.
Yeah.
But so it became something we sort of just carried with us then.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of a women's only space because it's like hyper connectedness to the space that naturally develops often, but some people don't like it. Like I'm curious what you think. Like that experience was obviously quite positive. As you've gotten older and like lived throughout your life, what do you think of women only spaces at this point?
I still love them. It's sort of the most fun thing. And in fact, I remember a student. I was teaching a gender class once, and this male student said to me, toward the end of the quarter, he said, when I come into this class, it's this whole different sort of space, and I get into this whole different thing, and it takes most of the day for it to wear off.
Oh, that's lovely, actually.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So I think we both work hard to try to create that whenever we can.
Yeah, I've always been in women's salons, you know, groups that meet once a month. But I taught a women's studies seminar once. It was the culminating seminar in women's studies. And so I decided to have as their project for them to go out and explore women's groups that would not normally be considered feminist, but to try to figure out if they were feminist. So one went to the junior league, went to this belly dancing thing, all kinds of different groups. And they came back and said, these are all feminist groups because they're women. But women need to have an excuse to get together with each other. So they have to say, well, I'm going off to my belly dancing class or I'm going off to the junior league, because then it makes it sort of acceptable. But they said they're there for each other.
Yeah.
And that's why they're there.
Yeah. Like, so have you heard of The Wing? Do you know about this?
No.
So I lived in New York for 5 years up until recently when I moved to New Haven. Co-working is like a big thing, right? Like it's a shared office space. People are working on many different projects. Kind of over the 5 years that I was living there, this co-working space popped up that's women's only. It's called The Wing, and it's like explicitly women, and it's quite lovely space. It's a little bit commercialized. Like, there's some critiques of it, but overall, like, it seems quite lovely. And I have some friends that are members of it. It's also very excessively priced, and they have grown massively. So there's a number of spots now in New York, and then they're going to other cities as well. Simultaneously, over the last, I want to say 6 months, maybe a year, there's been lawsuits that have been brought forward because they're saying that they're discriminatory against non-women, against men, like, right? And so, and it's just, I do not know how to answer this, because I think there's a clear need for this type of space, and there's a clear hunger for this type of space, because membership's just like shot through the roof, right? Like, they've expanded, it's a big deal. If you let men into these spaces, the tone of them changes.
Right.
It is also, I guess, technically discriminatory to be like, no men allowed. I don't know how we deal with this. I'm curious for your thoughts on, like, because if it was a men's only club, which there have been time and all eternity, you know, there have been these men's only clubs that I think are terrible. But at the same time, I want women's only clubs. I don't know how to deal with this.
Right. Well, except I guess one thing is there are other spaces men can go to.
Right.
Right. There are. This is not the only one.
Tons and tons and tons of co-working spaces men can go to.
Exactly. Exactly.
And in most workplaces, still, men are the majority in lots of them.
Right. Like, do we have women's only spaces until there's such equality in that realm that, like, we kind of don't need them anymore? And so then we do away with them?
Well, but I also think there's a need for men to be in men's only spaces. And I have a friend who's a volunteer firefighter, and he just loves that group of men that he's with. And he'd never sort of had that experience before. You know, men on the football team or men.
Soldiers. They all talk about how close they become.
Yeah, I guess, as an oppressed population or as like a marginalized population, I sometimes get nervous about men-only spaces, because I think you fools are going to do some dirty business in there. You know, like,
well, they always have.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm like, I don't trust it. I don't trust you.
Well, that's why they don't like women-only spaces too. They think we're going to do what they're doing.
Actually, that's a really good point.
And we're not.
Exactly.
We don't care about them when we're in that space.
Right.
They still care a whole lot about us because they're worried about us.
That's a really good point. I mean, when you're in private spaces and you believe that you control other humans like property, then you're going to spend a lot of time scheming on that situation.
Right.
But women don't. I've never met a woman that believes they control other beings as property.
Well, right. They don't need to.
Right. Like, there's it's such a different.
Yeah.
That's not the reason
you're in the world.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's so interesting.
We should also throw in here, I think, though, that we don't want to kind of essentialize people.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Not all men are the same and not all women are the same.
Of course.
And not all women would behave the same in this space, and not all men would. And,
yeah.
And I know some men who would fit perfectly well in a woman's space.
Right.
We've made men, some men, honorary women in our lives.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, I think definitely, like, not all men are the same. I do think the space itself would change and the tone. And, like, it's less about, like, the introduction of non-women. It's more about the introduction or it's more about, like, the behavior of the women in the space would change because of that introduction rather than the person who's entering necessarily.
Yeah, we've seen that a lot in classes.
Really? Can you tell me more about that?
Well, if it's a gender class and there's only one man, sometimes the women will start sort of catering to him or...
Yeah, have you noticed... I noticed this a few times when I've taught gender studies. There's a lot of, like, caveats around men when men are in the room, like, oh, well, not you though, like,
right.
Or like, oh, we like you, but oh, not to hurt your feelings, but
right,
it's there's something there.
Yeah
So you went to your master's programs.
Yes.
And then how long did the master's program take?
1 year.
Oh, they're 1 year masters. Okay.
Yeah. And then we went for our PhDs. Sonia went to Northwestern and I went to the University of Iowa.
Okay.
And then when we finished that, we got jobs as professors.
Did you finish right around the same time?
We did.
Yes. Yeah, we did finish the same time.
And what did you study the same thing?
Yes. Communication.
But our dissertations were both on the women's movement in various ways.
Yeah. What was, like, tell me about each of your dissertations. I'm curious.
Oh, mine was an analysis of the debate on the Equal Rights Amendment, which was going on at the time.
And we still have not.
We haven't.
I literally can't believe. Like, it's so, it boggles my mind.
I know. Except that now most states have passed laws. I mean, it's not so much needed, but it would be a nice symbolic gesture.
Right, right.
The other day I came across the black armband I wore when the ERA failed.
Yeah, we both had ERA bracelets that we wore for years.
Like POW bracelets?
They're ERA bracelets.
Oh, my gosh.
That you never took off until the ERA passed, but of course it didn't pass.
And did you still wear them after it didn't pass?
No. But I still have mine.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. What was it like when that happened? Like when it didn't pass? Like what were you feeling?
Well, first of all, I think there was a lot of optimism when they actually extended the deadline. We thought, oh, this will happen.
And I actually marched in D.C. to extend the deadline, and that was amazing. Everybody wore white, and it was hundreds of thousands of people. So it was really optimistic then, but then.
It's so shocking that it didn't. It's like such an easy thing. Yeah. Like it seems like, but it's a reminder, I think, that like discrimination by gender is like the last remaining acceptable discrimination,
it seems.
Every other, other discrimination still exists, of course, but you wouldn't outright say like, oh, I support this discrimination here and there.
Right.
But there is this still like slight acceptance of misogyny and discrimination based on gender.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of our favorite books at the time was the text of the ERA, because it's really very simple, but people thought it covered all kind of things. So this book is just the text over and over and over.
Yeah, it's a thick book. Each page is the text of the ERA in a different font.
Like it's very complicated.
Right, it's this
many pages.
Yeah.
Really repeated over and over.
Right.
That's hilarious.
Tell about your dissertation.
Yeah,
oh, dissertation? So I compared three different women's groups, the National Organization for Women, Women's Equity Action League, which was the conservative spinoff from NOW, and then the Feminist, which was a radical spinoff from NOW.
The Feminist, it was called.
The Feminist.
I've heard of NOW, but I haven't heard of the...
Women's Equity Action League.
Yeah, nor the...
The Feminist.
Yeah, I've never heard of those.
Women's Equity Action League was opposed to abortion, so that's what their main kind of... But so they were kind of a conservative, professional women's group.
Okay.
And the Feminist was extremely radical. They realized things like who talks more has more power in a group. So everyone in the group was given a certain number of tokens, and every time you talked, you threw one into the middle of the room. And when your tokens were done, you were done talking for that meeting.
Oh, wow.
So
they really tried to enact equality.
Was this a small group, like in one location?
It started in New York City by T. Grace Atkinson. So they went for, I don't know,
several years.
Yeah.
I think they were in different locations, weren't they? Or was it just there?
Yeah, I can't remember.
It was called The Feminist?
The Feminist. Yeah.
And it's not alive anymore? It's not?
No, I'm sure it's not.
Oh my gosh, I find it shocking that I haven't heard about this group, nor the other one. I'm actually really interested in exploring this, like the logic around and the feelings around pro-life feminists.
Mm.
This is a very interesting area that I don't have a lot of interaction with. And I think is an area that we're lacking discussion around in the feminist movement. So the conservative group, Women's Equity
Action League.
Action League.
Their papers of all these groups are actually at the Northwestern Library. Remember, I went up there.
To
collect all this stuff. So the papers are still around.
Wow.
I mean, I'm sure the collection still exists. Some kind of feminist collection there.
Right.
So,
when you did your PhDs, was it technically a joint degree, like communications, gender studies, or women's studies, or something? Or
no, there was no gender studies or women's studies then. The first women's studies program started in about 1972, and we got our degrees in 1976, our PhDs.
Oh, okay, yeah.
There was no feminist anything.
We had no female professors.
Oh, really?
No.
What was your experience then? Writing these, like, you know, very feminist dissertations among the man folk, if you will. Like, what?
Fortunately, I think my advisor, all of his female advisees later sort of acknowledged that he was sort of the feminist professor to go to. And he was much more willing to, you know, let us do what we wanted. So all the feminists kind of gravitated toward him. So that helped a lot, I think, that he was there.
Yeah. And I guess because I went in knowing I wanted to study the ERA and I got assigned to him and I said, this is what I want to study. And he said, fine. But it was true that at the time, nobody studied anything related to women in our field. At the time, the field studied speeches by great men, great white men.
Dead men.
Great white dead men. Huh. And so they never studied women. So we started studying women speakers. And then
I remember once raising my hand and saying, I said, okay, if I write my paper about a woman. I mean, it was
just, a really quick question. Can I write about a woman?
Exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't done.
And the field had just started studying social movements. And so they never thought of studying feminist movements.
Of course not.
So, we up and said, we'll study this one.
Right. it's interesting to hear. I'm curious if there was ever any backlash, like in your career. It sounds like during studies, it was quite amicable and supportive. But then afterwards, were there ever points where there were difficulties? So I've come up against it a number of times. I have a master's in gender studies, and then I've gone on to do like a data science master's, and now I'm doing a political science PhD. And I've worked in the feminist space for so long. It's been 10 years. So, it's just like, it's kind of, once you know the knowledge, you can't really go back. And so it's like the way you see the world. And I'm still confronted, even now, as of literally like 2 months ago, something happened in a classroom where it's like this belittling of this type of work. So I was told, this was so frustrating. I was told gender theory is really interesting, but it will never be published in a political science journal. And I was like, are you asking me to hit you? Are you like, is this what, like, I don't, like, I was.
Well, of course it is published.
Right. It literally is. And also, like, I don't even know how to respond to that. This was from a professor. And I was just like, is this 2018? I don't even know where we're at. Like,
right. Wow.
Have you ever had experiences like this?
Yeah. I went on an interview. It was my first interview. And
at Marquette,
a nice Catholic school. And I don't know why. I mean, if you looked at my vita, you would have said there's not probably a very good fit here. But so I walk into the room and all the professors are old, white-haired men. That's all there is. And they're all sitting around a table and they plot me down. And the first question they ask, if a student was to raise their hand in your class and ask, he probably said, raise his hand in your class, and ask your view of abortion, what would you say? And I said, I would tell them that was not an appropriate question for the classroom. So I answered the question, but I didn't answer it, and I didn't get the job.
Did they stop the interview, right? Like,
no.
Okay, thank you.
No, but I thought I might as well just walk out right now. Why am I wasting my time?
Oh, my gosh. That's such an intense question, too. Oh, my gosh. But
when I think I didn't get a job because we've written lots of books, and one of them is a public speaking book where we totally reconceptualize the public speaking models based on feminist principles. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to people at this school and they were all excited about that I'd applied. And then they wanted to see this public speaking book. So I gave it to them. And then I got a letter saying, well, we want a little more traditional approach to public speaking at our university.
Oh my goodness. Meaning women should be seen and not heard?
Or like, we don't want feminist principles kind of intervening in our discipline.
Oh my goodness. when does it stop, I wonder? Or does it ever stop? I always have these kind of like delusions, frankly, where I'm like, oh, I've reached this phase. I'm in this space now. It'll be fine. People will get this. Like, I won't have to entertain these idiotic questions. Like, I've had people say to me, well, there's two genders, men and women, done. I answered it for you. Gender's over. Like it's kind of like ridiculous comments, like just dumb questions. And I think I've passed the phase. And then I enter a space and I'm like, oh, wait, we're still dealing with people. They're like not even baby feminists. They're like, they're just not even seeing this as a thing.
Yes. I think that's less the case in our discipline. I think probably the problem in our discipline now, not when we started, but now there's almost a feminist kind of group think or a conformity that's kind of odd.
Oh, interesting.
And so you have to say certain things and you have to come to certain conclusions.
Tell me more. Like, what is, like, I've had hints of this,
yes,
I think.
Like, you always have to talk about race, class, gender altogether.
Yeah.
You don't make mention of that.
You can't just focus on one.
You can't just focus on one. Mm. You always have to come to the conclusion that things are really bad and people are all oppressed. You can't come to any kind of other conclusion like, oh, these people are being really creative about the strategies they're using.
Mm. And we do find this odd because critical theory, which is sort of the dominant paradigm these days, is supposed to be about emancipation and liberation. You're supposed to examine these structures mm-hmm. and figure out how to get out of those. But nobody ever gets to that point.
They just focus on the oppression.
They just say, people are oppressed. Here's an example of oppression. People are oppressed.
Yeah. I mean, so I took a course with Dr. Christy Dotson this last term. It was really good. It was called Epistemic Oppression, which is this, it's within the philosophy department, which is like, you know, not my area of expertise at all. I was frankly like a little bit outside my depth. So I called it Black Feminist Theory because that's a little more like accessible for my brain. So, and it was a great course. And one of the things she talked about and that we read about was this idea of like the imagined possibilities, right? Like the we can locate the problem, we can locate the oppression, but can we take it a step further and like imagine the next level, imagine the liberation? And without that imagining,
we can't actually
make it happen.
Right. Exactly.
I wonder if that, because we're at a phase, I think the feminist movement is quite good at this as well, is like we're really good at picking things apart and critiquing locating problems.
Right. But we've now done that for a very long time. I think we know what the problems are.
And I think we also need to acknowledge feminism as a movement has been amazingly successful. And we don't acknowledge that enough. I mean, it's probably the most successful movement in the United States.
Right, and it's been going for so long.
And the kind of change that it's generated, it's amazing.
Like, even just in the course of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
But then when you compare it for 1800s to now, it's huge.
Right. I mean, what would your, kind of following along with this line of thought, what would your imagined possibilities be? Like, what would you, so we've located the problems. We're able to talk about the oppression. What would you like us to talk about next? Like, carry forward, whether it's, you know, your personal vision or others. I'm curious if you have, like, kind of wise words to share.
So maybe for all of us that are still angry.
So
maybe this is a good time to talk about. We've come up with two major kinds of strategies.
Yeah.
And so we have the ones that traditionally get used, and then we have some other ones that we think should be added.
Okay.
And so, we should probably say that these were inspired by people like Sally Miller Gerhardt, Sonia Johnson, who was excommunicated from the Mormon Church, Gloria Anzaldúa, people who said you can't get from here to here unless you do something different. And they have various approaches for doing something different.
And it was also inspired by the fact that we sometimes see the same strategies being used that were used like in the 70s. This doesn't fit. Why are you doing this? And an example mm-hmm. is Ms. Magazine. When Ms. Magazine came out, they had in an early issue a list of women who'd had abortions. Well, that was major at the time. Nobody talked about abortion. It was illegal. And so that was a major strategy, an interesting strategy. So a few years ago, they did the same thing.
Like in 2006.
Huh.
Published names of women who'd had abortions. And they said they wanted to stimulate public dialogue around abortion. And we thought, how is this going to do that?
And which legislators do you know of who are reading Ms. Magazine? Which judges are reading Ms. Magazine? And so what? What are they going to do with this?
Actually, you know, and this makes me think of this podcast that I've heard a lot of people talk about, especially those that consume podcasts, which I am definitely one. There's a podcast called, I think it's called Abortion Diaries, and it's a woman who traveled around. I don't know if it's still going. I think it's still going, but it's people sharing stories about their abortions, like in great detail and very personal and intimate. And I think perhaps that's the next phase of this list. And I would love to think that Ms. is, or I guess the feminist majority. I have a hard time separating the two in my brain, Feminist Majority Foundation and then Ms. Magazine. Like, it would be lovely if they would like kind of get involved and support this as the new wave of or phase of this list.
Right.
That's a really good example of your...
Well, and even the women's marches after Trump got elected. I mean, lots of excitement and all. And I think they probably changed the people who marched. But I don't know if they had any other impact.
I don't, sometimes I, like, I get frustrated when we try to make things bigger than they are. Like, for me, I'm like, it was a march. That's what it was. It served its purpose. It doesn't need to have a policy agenda or some sort of organization behind or around it, which I think is the phase that the march organizers or the march itself is going into. Why can't it just be a march? Why can't it just be what it is and like raise awareness? I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's perfectly appropriate perspective on it. But I suspect that the people who've marched thought they were doing something other than that.
Yeah.
I think they thought they were influencing Trump.
Do you think they have influenced Trump?
Nah.
I mean, I don't think that he cares about anything, but.
No. I don't think he even talked about the women's marches, which was a little unusual for him.
Actually, maybe you're right.
Yeah, we were trying to figure that out. We were trying to think of that. I don't know whether he did or not.
Yeah, I don't think he may have just like not uttered. I know there was discussion around like my inauguration was so huge and amazing.
Yes,
right,
yes.
And that was somehow juxtaposed against the women's march. But I don't know if he ever actually uttered the women's march.
Right.
Which was huge. I was there in D.C.
Oh,
it was
wow.
Massive. Like so many people. It was a little overwhelming, frankly. I don't know. Okay, so I'm sorry. Okay, I keep interjecting. Right, continue.
I'll first summarize the traditional strategies that we tend to use. Okay, so first of all, the basic strategy is using persuasion to try to get other people to change. Okay? So you're focused on material features of the world. So people, places, systems, organizations, documents, laws, and you're trying to change those. And so your focus is on people who either cause the problem or people who can do something about it. So you're trying to get them to change. And in addition to getting them to change, you've got to get other people around you to go with your vision of the world that you're trying to get these people to go with. So it's a lot of work. You're trying to get all these people to line up with this one view. And then the efforts, of course, are measured by whether or not those material conditions change. Okay, so that's sort of the basic model. Mm-hmm. So we've come up with another another change strategy, which we came to from feminist things, Native Americans, all sorts of marginalized
quantum physics.
Oh, wow.
So you've
really put together like a whole conglomeration of different
yes.
ideas.
Because the pieces are out there in the world. They're just not.
Haven't been pulled together.
At least they haven't been pulled together in the communication discipline.
Right? Yeah.
Right. So in this second kind of change strategy, the focus is on the use of symbolic resources. So by that we mean spoken, written, visual symbols and the thoughts, interpretations, perceptions, and meanings that are encoded in those symbols. And so that means unlimited resources are available to us because we can always come up with another word, with thus another thought, with another perspective. And so the key strategy instead of persuasion is interpretation. So it's how are we interpreting something? How are we assigning meaning to something? And we've got total choice about that. And so everything's invented. And because it's all invented, we can create stuff in all anew.
How does that work for like breaking down oppressive structures? So like you identify the structure, like this thing that's happening is oppressive and this is why. Yeah. And that's the interpretation element?
Yes, well, that's more just sort of definition of the problem, I would say.
Okay.
But so in response to that, you can either stay focused on the oppression and how awful it is, or you can say, what else could I do here to make my life better, more meaningful, more interesting?
Maybe we need to back up to it and say one of the major ideas behind this, too, is something that's really a truism in the communication discipline, that symbols create a reality. Mm-hmm. We create a reality through how we talk about something, how we think about something. And so we always have a choice of, I can change my mind and I can change reality. Mm-hmm. And we were talking this morning about when we were little, our father told us this story that really kind of reinforced this idea. He was in some house, and we have no idea whose house, and it was really, really, really hot.
And he was in an attic room, so, and no air conditioning, of course.
And he wanted to open the window, but the window was stuck. And he tried and tried and tried to get the window unstuck. And so finally, he got so frustrated, he just threw his shoe at the window and broke it. And he just felt the cool air come in, and it was so nice and easy to sleep. Next morning, he got up and he discovered he'd broken the mirror, not the window. But your symbols create your reality.
Yeah.
So if that's sort of the foundation. So whatever you focus on is what you get. Whatever, and Sonia Johnson is a great one. Let's talk about this. Whatever you resist persists. So whatever you keep focusing on and banging up against and resisting, that's, you're going to get more of that.
Her one example is, she said, imagine patriarchy as this fort on a hill, and women have been coming at it for hundreds of years now with their battering rams. And she said, what do you think patriarchy is doing? They're reinforcing every door and window, and we keep trying to get in. And she said, let's just stop focusing on patriarchy. Let's go down the hill and make our own life. That's the only way it's going to disappear, if we stop focusing on it.
Yeah, so it's the idea of, like, imagining another possibility.
Yes.
I mean, there's a tension that I often find in my life where you want to divorce yourself from these oppressive structures and imagine a new possibility, but you simultaneously have to work within the structures to some degree. So the easiest one to think about, I think, is, like, capitalism, right? Like, really hyper-capitalist societies like ours in the U.S. are really super exploitative. But at the same time, you need money to eat. So, like, how do you interact where you can still actually literally survive as a human, but also imagine a new possibility?
Yes. So, yes, certainly capitalism is super exploitative. But it's also given a whole bunch of advantages to some people.
True.
It's been the thing that's allowed them to thrive and rise. And so there's some good things about it. And,
right.
And it's helped some people. Mm-hmm. So I'd focus there.
Okay.
And just living the kind of life within capitalism that makes sense to you. In other words, not engaging in exploitative practices yourself, mm-hmm. trying, you know, not shopping at Walmart.
Right.
I mean, there are all kinds of individual strategies you can use that make you feel better about a place in the system.
Yeah.
Well, go there.
So maybe we can talk about some strategies that we think fit with this
interpretation. Yes, please. Thing. Yeah, that'd be great.
So do you want to start, Ken, with reframing?
Sure. So, for example, you can always just choose to reframe something, put it in another frame of some kind, define it differently. And a good example of this is the Dalai Lama, who in exile said, if I had just stayed in my own country, I would not have had access to the certain people, perspectives, ways of being in the world that I have. And it's been a real opportunity, a real blessing to have been exiled.
So many people would go, oh, I'm exiled. Oh, how horrible this is. Oh, I want to go back to my country. He doesn't see it that way at all. Mm-hmm. He's totally reframed. Mm-hmm. A second thing that we like, a second strategy, is appreciation. Appreciation ahead of the fact. So not being grateful after somebody, like, something nice, but to go into a situation like capitalism and saying, yeah, there's all these bad things, but what can I find to appreciate about this? Mm-hmm. And Alice Walker tells this really interesting story about this tribe in South Africa. And if somebody in their community has done something harmful or inappropriate, they put this person in the center of the village and everybody comes and they all talk for as long as they can about all the good things this person has done. And sometimes it takes days.
Oh, and then, that's so lovely, actually.
Yes, and then they have a big celebration, and they welcome the person back into the community.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah. She actually gave that talk right after 9/11.
Oh.
I think, trying to say, we could handle this
a
bit differently.
Right.
Right.
And a third strategy is an enactment, and we've sort of alluded to this, but
you just live in the world the way you want the world to be.
Yeah, so it's Gandhi's thing. Sonia Johnson talks a lot about this. Your power is here now. And Sonia Johnson is great about it. She talks about past, present, and future are all collapsed together. We think it's chronological, but quantum physics tells us otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so what you are doing now is what you're going to get in the future. Yeah. If you're on your knees begging to get your rights, in the future you're going to be on your knees getting your rights, begging for your rights. Mm-hmm. So you need to live now as though you have the rights. You need to feel now the way you thought you would feel once you got them. So a good example from the civil rights movement.
I was going to say, the kids who sat in at the lunch counters, they sat there, they studied, they acted
as though they belonged there.
Yes.
So freedom as an inside job. they were enacting the freedom that they were asking for right then.
Yeah, that's incredible. I am trying to think of like where we would put this in today's world where like I think about like, you know, there's no place in the world that is free of misogyny or discrimination or these like terrible patriarchy things. Right
here, we're free.
Yeah, true. That's right here. In this exact moment.
Everywhere we go, we can create that.
Yeah. And like, but like, how do you create it in a world where, like in the US, the bad things sometimes are quite insidious. So you don't know they're there until they kind of rear their head. And I was talking with a friend like about discrimination in the workplace. And so for a lot of young women, we're told we can do anything, like, you know, go there, do this, do, you know, take over the world. And you get into these professional spaces and it's a gigantic wake up call because, you know, kind of what seemingly out of nowhere, some real shit will happen. And then you're often left not knowing how to deal with it because you didn't even realize it was there. You weren't given the tools to deal with it. Like, it's just kind of so disorienting. When it's like that, when you like don't know the bad stuff is there, you don't even know that you have to envision or create a new space. Like, how do you do this?
Well, that would be the wake up call to go create the new space.
Okay, good. Yes.
Yeah, and, true. And I mean, in academia, you see it all the time. You know, something happens, some silly little stupid thing, and the person gets all upset, and they're filing lawsuits, and they're alienating their colleagues, and they're in angst. And good heavens, you've got choices.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead, go to that person and say, can we start over? Can we go out to lunch? Can we talk about this?
But what if the person, like doesn't see you as legitimate or doesn't see you as, like, sees you as then, subpar, like, because of who you are?
Who cares?
Like, do you screw see them do you, next?
No, screw them. Appreciate them.
All right.
You've got,
but you're
you've
not going to change them.
You're not going to change
it's
them.
True.
But you know you're legitimate. Right?
Yeah.
You act as though you're legitimate. You do good work. You do what you're supposed to do to accomplish whatever you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And you'll you do let far them be that way then.
It's true. I mean, I think, because what do they say? Like if you take in anger and hate, if you let it like sit within you, it'll fester and it like destroys you more than it destroys the other
exactly.
person.
Exactly.
And a lot of like social movement activists now are saying, the key thing that has to happen is that the activists themselves have to change.
Yeah.
That putting anger and despair out in the world is not helping. That we need to feel joy. We need to feel what is it we want in the world.
Yeah.
And there's been all sorts of things about how you feel and how you're perceiving things affects the material world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the things that I think about and the work that I do is around the way that like we make meaning, and by making the meaning, we are also made. It's like this cycle,
exactly.
Right? Like
yes.
we're like going through this. And it seems like your work really centers around that as well. This, we are the reality we make the reality, like this simultaneous.
Right. Yes. Right.
Well, for example, a long time ago, we stopped going to Take Back the Night marches.
Oh, okay.
Because we're perfectly safe in the night. If you think you have to take back the night, That suggests a particular vision of reality that we don't want to buy into.
Yeah.
I walk very safely through the night.
What are some of the things that you suggest we do moving forward? You know, do you have kind of like concrete ideas for things we should really be spending our time on as the feminist movement or like as individuals? Or?
Well, I guess it would be some new change strategies and not just relying on those traditional persuasion. I'm going to get this person to change. It's so hard to get someone else to change.
Yeah.
The best example that we like is Sonia Johnson, who had four kids. And she said it dawned on her one day, these four kids love me, but I've never been able to get them to do one single thing I want in my entire life. How did I expect I could get the bishops of the Mormon Church or the legislators in Utah
or the Supreme Court justices to change
their minds because I asked them to? So where was I coming from? What was I thinking? It doesn't happen. So get a grip and go do something else.
Yeah, so I guess we would like the feminist movement too. And we're not saying never use persuasion.
Sure.
We think, yes, sometimes that's the appropriate thing to do and we use persuasion. But there is a whole other set of strategies around interpretation and creating your own reality and creating what you want, what you're imagining and the possibilities for the future. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to see a little more focus on that.
Yeah, and I think that would also kind of invigorate the movement a bit, because I know, I mean, perhaps this is just those that are in my circle, but it's exhausting. Feminism,
exactly.
Like to live in the world as a feminist, to live in the world as a woman,
and
is
how
just hard.
It should be fun,
right? Like, where is the fucking joy?
Like, right. You know, yeah, exactly.
Like it's yeah, and sometimes I often ask people in these interviews, like, have you ever had a point or a moment where you're just like, that's it, I'm done, like I'm quitting, like I'm just going to pretend like I never knew this information or this stuff never happened, and I'm just going to, you know, seclude myself away or whatever. Everyone has those points, but then somehow we persist, somehow we continue. Have either of you ever had those points where you're just like, I'm done?
No.
No.
Really?
Well, no. We're feminists. You can't take that away.
Well, and it is a fun process. It is joy.
Yeah.
And it's been an evolution, but even when we're doing very traditional feminist work, it was just really exciting.
And well, especially when feminism was first coming into our discipline. Mm-hmm. It was so exciting, and it just changed everything. And it totally changed theories, and how much better can it get?
Yeah, also to be like right on the edge of that, it sounds, right, yes, sounds like both of you were,
yes,
you know, like,
yeah,
a kind of helping to usher that in.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, so we wrote books on, one book's called Women Speak. It's kind of forms of communication that women tend to use, because mm-hmm. we were only studying speeches. And we thought, there's lots of other ways women communicate. They don't just give speeches.
Yeah.
Well, and they hardly ever give speeches.
Right, right. At the time, that was certainly true. Yeah. Or we did a book on feminist rhetorical theories, where we came up with the communication theories coming from feminist theorists. Mm-hmm. And they're so radically different from the other communication theories we had.
Yeah, I mean, I was in doing a bit of background research about your work, I started to really look at the idea of rhetoric and how rhetoric is used differently in different spaces, like the word, the term.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm curious, where do you position that in your work? You know, like, because you do a lot of work around this.
Yes. The easiest answer for me is to say that rhetoric is just an old term for communication.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. So it's our discipline started with the classical Greeks in the 5th century BC, and they called it rhetoric.
But it's not just the narrative. It's not just like the narrative that persists forward or kind of like all talk and no action.
No,
it's not
a very
popular,
old, very derogatory sense of it.
Yeah.
That's
no,
not.
It's any kind of communication, any kind of symbol use. So written, oral, visual symbols, so architecture, dress, music, all of that falls into rhetoric.
Okay.
And the old or the negative approaches to rhetoric or beliefs about rhetoric really came from classical Greece too, from Plato.
Right.
He didn't like rhetoric.
Yeah.
Or he didn't like the contemporary version of rhetoric. What was
the all talk and no action bit? Or
yeah, he didn't.
It was more complicated than that. Yeah. He wanted an ideal form of rhetoric, which he did not see operating.
I see.
Yeah.
And how does that intersect with your feminist work? Like when you think of rhetoric as this really expansive, you know, like the positive turn on it, like how does it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what gives all the possibilities, because you pick your symbols, you pick your interpretation, you pick your world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's everything.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
Well, I do remember the moment when the whole social construction of reality stuff came into the discipline. And you sort of had this moment where you said, oh, we're not just dealing with words that are real and that's all there is. There's this whole other possibility sort of inherent in the words that...
Well, I think we'd always believed that, though. Don't you think, growing up?
Well, yes, but we didn't have words for it.
Right, right.
And we didn't have the label of social construction.
Right.
When you think about the feminist movement today and how it's, like, I even struggle to call it the feminist movement, right? Like, it's just right. So kind of fractured is a negative word, but it's, like, so diverse and multifaceted, yes, and is, kind of, like...
Yeah, there are feminist movements.
Yeah, it's just, like, kind of all so many different kind of avenues you can
And isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, I find it amazing. In another sense, I'm like, I'm exhausted. I don't know which one to do. I don't know where to go. You know, like, what's
going on?
Just have
to do one. Yeah. Don't define yourself as being exhausted or fragmented or scattered. Nobody can do everything, so you get to pick.
What do you think are the kind of the most important or salient issues to really focus on today?
I'm going to give the same answer. The change strategies.
Change strategies. Okay.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because that's at the heart of everything. I mean, that affects every issue.
Yeah. And also, I think it affects like the longevity of these movements, right?
Exactly.
Like the ability to keep going.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
How do you position yourselves within these movements today? Like, what do you think about your own evolution kind of as feminists and the way that the thought has kind of progressed forward and kind of taken all these different avenues? Like, because I know some feminist academics and scholars and activists, like everybody has kind of their own unique relationship with these changes.
Well, I think we probably went through sort of the traditional evolution. I mean, we started out thinking feminism was
about
women
equality.
Getting equal to men. Mm. And then I think for a while we went with Bell Hooks's definition, which I think we still kind of adhere to, of
dealing with the systems of oppression.
Right. Yeah. And challenging the ideology of oppression that characterizes our culture.
And in whatever form, not just gender.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then I think we've moved to this interpretive approach to feminism, saying feminism has to be about changing your choice of interpretation about something.
Mm-hmm. And so it's about being as creative as you can in making your interpretive choices, trying to survey a bunch of options before you settle on one.
Yeah.
So you're sure this is the world I want, okay? So I'm going to pick this strategy.
But it's okay to change your view of the world, too. You don't need to get locked in on that one either.
Right, right.
But so I guess I don't think of myself as having a relationship to particular feminist organizations or points of view anymore. I've just always been a feminist, and I'll always be a feminist. And
I think our focus has always been on doing feminism theoretically, changing things in the communication discipline, and then we write off the textbooks, so getting the word out to students through those.
And then enacting it in our own lives.
Right. But we are actually, tomorrow we have this woman we've maybe met once. She's coming to stay here for 2.5 days, and we're going to brainstorm, maybe, we think, of new textbook on feminist rhetorical theories.
Oh, and she's of young women.
Of young women.
Young feminists.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she's like 40 years old. Oh. And so she's more in touch with pop culture than we are. And so she has this idea to update the book on feminist rhetorical theories that we wrote earlier, using feminist comedians, feminist singers, you know, people
comics.
Who claim that, like,
we haven't read most of these people.
But we're gonna talk for 2.5 days and
see what we end up with.
So maybe we'll find a new place for ourselves in the feminist movement. Who knows?
Among the pop culture.
That's right.
That's hilarious. What tips do you have to share? This is like one of my last questions. It's kind of when you think about your life, and if someone listens to this and they think, I want to be both of you, how do I become you?
I think keep a sense of balance. Coming into the academy when we did, and you know what was there and what wasn't there, you sort of have to say, I want to be here because I like being in the academy, but you also have to balance that with, it's not going to be perfect.
And I guess I would say have a little courage. Break the rules. What fun is it to say what's already been said or do what's already been done?
Right. Yeah, what's the point of that?
It's been said, so let's go do something else.
And
I think perseverance.
Yeah.
Just deciding what you want to do and keep at it.
Yeah. And don't take the pitfalls too seriously. Don't take yourself too seriously. You're just doing what you can, living a life.
Well, I think maybe another strategy, and this term comes from Kenneth Burke, perspective by incongruity, where you put two things together that don't go together usually, like postal service. That's a joke, but but like Arabian Puritanism, you know, Puritans. So I think that's sort of been one of our strategies, that we've put things together that don't always go together.
So then it keeps people sort of unsettled or not quite sure
where
to put us.
Okay.
And so if there's not a particular place for you, you can move around a little bit more.
Because people aren't paying quite as much attention because they don't know.
They don't know how to pin you down.
Exactly.
Because you're like, I refused to be pinned.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think, one of the things is I think how we dress. I mean, we wear makeup, blah, blah, blah.
Bright colors.
Right. Yeah. But I don't think we fit what some people's idea of feminist is.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah. or especially in the early parts of the women's movement, or when you're supposed to be, not care about dress, be kind of frumpy looking. We weren't that.
Right. I remember one time, older man I met found out I'd gone to this march for the ERA, and he said, Sonia, you can't be one of them. You have curly hair. So I think, making it hard for people to pin you down gives you some room for movement.
Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. That's really great advice. It definitely speaks to the way that I prefer to navigate the world, which is wild and free.
Yeah, so.
Perfect.
Yeah. And I think it actually helped that we were twins.
Yeah.
We always had each other.
You have a really nice support system.
Yeah,
with one another.
Yes. I don't think we would have survived high school if we hadn't had each other. Oh, I mean, sure. I'm sure we would have.
Yeah, but it would have been very sad.
So much easier.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And writing together has been fun.
Yeah.
How has it been as you've both developed kind of your own private lives, your families and you live in different cities and, how does how does this connection kind of stay through and how have you supported one another?
I think it's interesting that neither of us had kids.
Mm.
Sonia's husband once said to her, okay, Sonia, if I'm drowning and Karen's drowning, who are you going to save?
And I said, I can't answer that. But so, both our husbands know we have this other primary affiliation.
Yeah.
And when we get together, they're just ignored. And they know that.
Yeah.
They become support systems for the twins.
But I also think, I never wanted kids, but I think it would have been too much competition with my relationship with my sister.
Yeah.
Right.
They would not have fared well.
Was there a lot of pressure to have children?
No. Oddly enough, no.
I think our mother didn't necessarily want kids. I mean, she was a fine mother.
Yeah.
But I think we kind of got the sense of, I think I'd rather be doing something else. So she never pressured us.
No.
And I sort of think I knew at a really early age that, I look now, I was just on this trip and I said, I was watching some mother with a little kid and I thought, oh my God, I wouldn't have lasted half an hour. And then what would I have done?
Yeah.
Oh, Lordy.
Yeah, it's definitely not for everyone. I don't have children either, but I'm definitely at that point where I'm trying to decide, what do I do? And I'm also partnerless. So I think, what do? I do it alone? Do I not do it? Do I, it's all of these big decisions. I am still a few years away from, making the final decision, but it feels fairly large.
Well, and our system is set up to be.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, we love Sonia Johnson, so I keep quoting her, but she says, kids should be raised in this communal environment.
Yeah.
And so whoever at the time feels like, I really want to feed that kid now, they go do it. So the kid always knows, this person is doing this because they want to.
Right.
Otherwise, you're always with somebody who's doing stuff for you that often doesn't want to at that moment.
Right.
And Sonia Johnson actually divorced her kids.
No, she didn't divorce her kids. She divorced motherhood.
Sorry, I don't know anything about this. What is
this? So she said, when you're a mother, anything your kids can do can make you feel bad.
Yeah.
You are never free of that tie.
Yeah.
And she's really, really, really committed to living this feminist life where she says, I get to choose. And with four kids in the world, she said, I didn't get to choose my emotions.
Did
my
she
feelings.
Wait until they were adults?
Yes. Or she did.
I think the youngest one might have been only 16 or 17.
But yes, she said, I love you, but I'm not going to have any more contact with you.
Oh my God.
And she hasn't.
And she's stuck with it.
That's super intense.
She did Google her daughter. She knows where she lives.
Oh.
I wonder how her children feel. Because that's a really tough line to toe because, at one point, on one side, you, really can't divorce yourself from, if you're still in contact, you can't divorce right. yourself from that connection and that guilt or that,
right.
that feeling of the kind of taking on of right. their action. But at the same time, like they're part of you, you know, like you want, you love
right.
them. Like
right.
You,
right.
Yeah. No, she said it was the hardest thing she'd ever done. Yeah.
Wow. Right. Super intense. This is really yeah. interesting. I need to do more research. Yeah. On
right. Read Sonia Johnson. Yeah. She's got lots of books out.
But read them in order.
Okay. Yeah.
Because yeah. she starts with From Housewife to Heretic.
Okay. Yeah, she got excommunicated from the Mormon church, like that woman you interviewed did.
Yeah.
But this is long, long
yeah,
time
Kate
ago.
Kelly.
And then she always talks through her thought processes so you know exactly how she got to these things, which she's really consistent and internally.
And how did you get interested in her? Like, what was the connection there?
Well, she was really big on the ERA.
Right. But,
so
and
we
she
always...
fasted on the steps of the Illinois legislature. She was one of the ones at the very end. And so we just always knew about her. And then
we she put was, her in Feminist Rhetorical Theories.
Okay.
Yes, but then she was living in Albuquerque for a while. So we did some yes. convention programs around her work, and she was the respondent. And so we got to know her. And,
yeah.
So interesting.
So, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. Where can people find you if they want to get in contact or support your work? Like, what's the best way for people to kind of connect with you, if you would like to share?
Well, I have a website,
yeah,
soniafoss.com, so that tells information. I guess people can email us.
Yeah.
They can also buy your books.
They can also yes. buy our books. Mm-hmm. And those are all talked about on my website, actually.
Excellent.
With descriptions of them. And we probably should just mention the people we publish with most, Waveland Press. They're amazing because they let us, they trust us with really weird ideas.
Right.
Stuff
I think
that
we wouldn't have published nearly as much if we hadn't found them.
And we wouldn't have published such weird stuff.
Where are they out of? What's
Actually, outside of Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And they're a husband and wife publishing company, so they're very tiny.
How does that work in academia? I have a friend who published with Simon & Schuster, so more like what I call like mass consumption
yes.
book, right? Like for the kind of the
yeah,
broader
the
world.
Trade.
And it sits between... This book sits between academia and mass market. It's called The Sex Myth. It's a really fantastic book. But so that was my kind of like first understanding of the way that publishing works. But now that I've re-entered academia, I'm starting to realize actually this is a totally different publishing world. Like how does
yes.
this work exactly?
Well,
and the publisher matters, right?
Yes.
Like the-
yes. So there's sort of tiers of publishers and it's better to get in the top tier.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think Waveland Press is an example of sort of going in between things. I mean, they do mostly textbooks, so they don't do really heavy academic scholarly books.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's...
They're big in communications, or they're...
They have like
social justice.
I mean... criminal justice.
Criminal justice.
Anthropology, communication.
Right.
I think
so they have a limited number of disciplines they do.
It's really quite interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. But so typically you would submit a book proposal to a publisher and they would say, you know, they send it out for review and then they'd say yes or no.
And then they give you an advance or that doesn't happen in academia?
No. No. You will lose money on your books in academia. Actually, if it's a really scholarly book, you will lose money.
Yeah.
Right. but so the nice thing about Waveland is we probably submitted 3 book proposals, but after that they just said, write what you want. We'll take it.
Oh,
so we told them about this new book, and they said, sure.
Sounds good.
They're great.
Right.
They're great.
Excellent.
Well, anyway.
This episode was brought to you by Continuum. It was edited and produced by our executive producer, Jenny Saraswati, and her team at Jenny Media. Our theme song is Open Flames by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Jillian Foster, the founder of Continuum and the brains behind the Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab. To hear more episodes, subscribe via the Apple Podcast app or wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about Continuum and to join our community, visit continuumcollective.org.